We're on the third class of Everyday Dharma for Daily Life. So welcome back. And this is a really nice short journey through how to make our life meaningful and how to not waste time or get distracted and how to transform all of those really tedious, mundane things that we can't escape into the path to enlightenment. So it's a really good course because you don't necessarily have to be religious or Buddhist for it to be incredibly useful. So Everyday Dharma for Daily Life. So what's Dharma, first off? Dharma means to hold back from suffering. So to hold you safe, like a life vest, or to hold you on course, to hold true. So the Dharma, with a capital D, the Buddha's teachings, but also Dharma with a small d, meaning just the truth, a truth. So the Dharma part of this title is about how to see things realistically without distortion, to be in step with reality. And then that way we can take the essence of this life. The daily life part of things is to kind of recognize that, our life has limitations. It's not going to last forever. Our time is limited. And having meaning in life is what makes life, what gives us energy, what makes it bearable, useful, worthwhile. But we can't find the meaning of life out there. We have to find the meaning of life within. We have to actually create meaning for our life, bring the meaning to our life. And, while we might think, oh, it'd be great to have a perfect job or a perfect this or a perfect that, it's actually our mind that makes it pleasant or unpleasant, good or bad. And within this, we've been looking at how to take all of the chores and things that we resent and turn them into the path to enlightenment by hitchhiking metaphors on them, using their momentum. And we're also looking at how to take all the things that we love doing and making them our path to enlightenment, awakening, fulfillment, rather than just doing them, enjoying them, and then they're done and gone. So actually harnessing all that energy of enjoyment as well. So I'll just get the screen share up for just a little overview. So the course is based around what are called the five forces or the five superpowers, and they are natural forces within our life that function regardless of belief system. They're kind of universal experiences. And if we can harness these powers, these superpowers or forces, then we can really direct our life. We can make our life most meaningful. So the five forces are known as intention or the force of impetus. That was our first class, our motivation, our reason for doing things. And we're trying to bring it from just a default unconscious motivation to really building a strong and long-term far-sighted motivation that includes others, so it's really powerful. Then we looked at the force of familiarity or repetition, otherwise known as meditation. So how to set up a daily meditation practice and how to structure your practice so that it's sustainable, so you don't kind of fall off the wagon like I have many, many times, so we don't run out of energy. And why it's called the force of familiarity, it's becoming familiar with the causes of happiness, familiar with all of those things that result in our own peace of mind, energy, happiness, contentment, good-heartedness, all of those things. And so it includes the repetition within meditation, but also then what we do kind of for the rest of the day as well, what we familiarize our mind with. So this one is like using the force of advertising for good. And then today we're going to look at the white seed, the force of virtue. And so that is about investing in ourselves as a human being, planting positive seeds that will ripen into happy experiences, strength of character, self-confidence, self-worth, and a meaningful life. So planting the seed. And then the next two we'll do together next week, the force of repudiation and aspiration, which is kind of like the bookends of the day, what to do at the end of the day and how to fix up our mistakes. So you can see these five forces, they are universal. Also in today's topic, planting the white seed, planting the seeds of positivity, is just a really basic checklist, what to practice and what to avoid. So you may naturally already do this, but I've been a bit clueless and I really need things spelt out for me. What to do and why, what to do when you stuff up, what not to do. Like, I just wish I had have known this a lot earlier. I wish someone had convinced me why, because I have a natural aversion to rules. I just don't want to do a rule just because someone says, because it's like, well, who says? And what's your credentials and what's the point? So I need to be convinced. So hopefully I'll be able to share a little bit of that with you as well. What we can do though is start with the breathing meditation, because last week we looked at setting up a meditation practice and the preliminary, like a warm-up at the gym, is to do a really simple breathing meditation. So let's do that now. So settle your posture, two-point posture, straight spine, and then relaxed body. So the way to straighten your spine, imagine a fine thread of light running through your body, coming out the crown of your head. You're just being pulled gently upwards through your crown so that your posture naturally aligns. And once your back is straight and stable, then you can relax the body because the body is supported. So let your shoulders drop, let all the tension be released from the neck, roll down the shoulders and off the tips of the shoulders. And become present in the room, and then slowly draw your focus inwards. And just like you're there in your room and the rest of the world is going on around you, but you don't have to get up and follow it all. So the same with whatever the thoughts and feelings arise in the mind, just let that all exist in the periphery, but you don't have to kind of get up and follow them. Just let them be and ignore them, and instead bring your focus to the breath. Just be aware of the rhythm of the breath rising and falling. And then become aware that all around you is all the love and support of your friends and family, as well as all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the great saints, and all the altruistic people throughout history who have worked to better the world, that all of that good intentions and love and kindness manifests around you as blissful golden light. The love of all the Buddhas, all the wisdom and knowledge of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and all the great human beings throughout the ages, all surrounding you as blissful golden light. And then think that you breathe in through the right nostril, the golden light, and you breathe out all of the disturbing emotions and overwhelming negativities in the form of black smoke through the left nostril. So breathe in the golden light, fills your whole body. And as you breathe out, it just, that light pushes out all of that darkness, all of the negativities in the form of smoke. So three times. And then when you're ready, swapping the nostrils over. And so this time breathing in through the left nostril, the blissful light that fills your whole body, so radiant and energized. And as you breathe out, that light pushes out all of the darkness, the disturbed negative energy or the confusion in the form of black smoke. And you just release that inner pollution. Feel how good it is to breathe it out. So the nostrils swapped over three times, long, leisurely breaths. And then three times in through both nostrils, out through both nostrils. And as you do this final three breaths, then I really feel that as you breathe in, all of that radiant light, it just flows through your whole body, all the atoms of your body, all of your nervous system, and it chases out the darkness. There's nowhere for it to go except out. So breathe out all the doubts and worries and anxieties and depression and disturbing emotions. Release all that inner toxicity. So through both nostrils, long leisurely breaths. And then from this sense of being energized and clear, just breathing in and out clarity and radiance. And from this internal spaciousness, then we can really set our motivation to be able to get the very most out of our life and to take the essence of this human life, to make it highly meaningful, to make a difference in the world, to traverse a spiritual path, to be able to help others to the utmost of your ability, to include the benefit of the entire world, and to not set any limit on it, but to be able to contribute in the most meaningful way, starting from within our mind, and then mirrored in all of our actions of body and speech. And then take a deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. And open your eyes if they're closed. I'm just going to stop the share for a moment. And, you know, last week we looked at some speed metaphors, and I was wondering, did anyone get think of any other speed metaphors to do? Anything else that came to mind? You know, we had, have I got my mobile? Have I got my mindfulness? Have I got my keys? Have I got my kindness? So did any other ones come up? Did you think of any other ones? something that you normally do? It's okay if you haven't, but I have from previous classes, some people came up with one. So when you're cleaning your teeth, you go, have I cleaned my teeth? Have I got my tact? I thought that was quite good. Filling up the car. So they like went to BP. So there's like Bodhisattva petrol. So you get the idea anyway. Were there any questions at all from last week? Anything about the hitchhiking meaning onto what we normally do?
Miffy, I had feeding the chickens, feeding my compassion.
Right. Great. Chickens and compassion, that's right. That's really good. And it's kind of apt, isn't it? Because we do all run around like chooks with our heads cut off going, ah! So, you know, to be able to offer big-hearted compassion like that, that's really nice. Yep. And it's probably handy, like, because, you know, every time our website breaks or whatever, you know, there's some stuff up with the IT, it is very tempting to run around like a chook just squawking going, oh, no. So many of us just react like that anyway, don't we? So we all need some compassion and care. All right, so let's have a look then. The force of the white seed. So how to really put this into context is, you know, we all want to feel appreciated, don't we? We all want to have a sense of self-worth, and we want people to like us. And instead of trying to make people like us or make people appreciate us, all we have to do to feel worthwhile is to do something worthwhile. It's just that simple. Because our feeling of worth doesn't come from outside of us. It doesn't come from others. Because even if other people tell us we're great, if we don't feel it, doesn't matter how many times they tell us, they'll just have to tell us over and over and over again, and it won't stick. So if we want to feel okay, if we want to feel confident and unafraid and worthwhile and have some sense of self-respect, it's incredibly simple. We just have to do something that is respectful, that is worthwhile. And the result, the side effect, is we'll feel better about ourselves. We'll naturally have high self-esteem. So the force of the white seed is really how to do this, our investment in ourselves as a human being. So an example of this would be when we were first learning to read. So we put a lot of effort. I can remember trying to learn to read and then at the same time, maybe a little bit later, trying to learn to write. And it was, I can remember the effort of it. But that initial investment, where it might seem a bit tedious and a bit hard and, you know, things don't flow, but once you get it, the results are infinite. Once you can read, then you can read anything, including how to become free of cyclic existence and become enlightened and then lead everyone else. So it's an amazing investment to make. So this is the kind of white seed that we want to plant that has this infinitely good potential to it. So it's not that there's just one benefit, but it continues to benefit and grow. And if we don't learn to read, for instance, we miss out on a huge, like a whole universe, don't we? So the force of the white seed, not to be underestimated. If we miss out on cultivating our good qualities, for instance, then we miss out on that whole universe of potential. So what we do and say, and also how we think, has huge consequences. It has far-reaching consequences, and how we act and how we speak very quickly becomes a habit, and becomes second nature, and then becomes our personality, our character. And then we can often think, oh, well, that's just me and there's nothing I can do about it. But we can always change, and we can always invest in ourselves as a human being more and bring out all of those nascent qualities that are there. Just like everyone has the potential to read, it's there. But whether we actually get a chance to learn how to read, that depends, doesn't it? So here we've got this chance to plant all those positive seeds so that they come to fruition in qualities, in our own qualities. And if we have these qualities, then we'll experience happiness in the future. And that's what we want. So this is how we get to be happy. We can't bully someone into making us happy. We can't force happiness. We can't buy happiness. We can't make people make us happy, all of those things. If we want to be happy, if we want peace of mind and a full heart and no fear, then this is how we do it. So if our activities are positive, it's like the positive seed, then the results will be happiness. Now, the thing about this is that we've got to figure out actually what's virtuous and what's not. And that's not necessarily so obvious. What's also so important about this, it's about our activities, how we physically act in the world and what we do, and our speech, and then also our mind. What I've noticed, especially at the moment, the current zeitgeist for the last few years, is that what we kind of do, and it happens in ads on TV, is we just say we're good as if that's going to make it true. We just, like on a job interview, say, oh, I have attention to detail, and just by saying it, it's as if it makes it true. I mean, everybody says it, don't they? There was an ad on TV a while ago where I think it was an insurance ad, and, you know, people were saving each other and saving a koala and helping a woman give birth. And it's like, and it's saying, this is what we do. This is who we are. We look after each other. But it's a fiction, isn't it? Because we don't. In the fires, who was looked after? Those people haven't got their money or their compensation. The JobKeeper, you know, the money's going down. We don't look out for each other. We don't save each other. But what was so effective about this ad was that just by the force of saying it, it was as if it made it true. And this attitude has crept into our whole life, that we go around and we say, I am a good person, as if that makes us a good person. But actually, if we look within, how do we know? So I had an epiphany about this quite a while ago, where I just assumed I was a good person. And then I noticed that, when push came to shove, when circumstances changed, I didn't actually respond very well at all. I was a bit shocked and ashamed at my response. And that's when I realized that just calling yourself a good person isn't enough. You actually have to embody it and act it out. So then it's like, oh, gosh, what do we do? So this force of virtue of planting the positive seeds means that after a while the momentum happens, and then we get exponential results. All good things come. Why do they come? Because of your good-heartedness, and because you are actually embodying your values, what matters to you in your actions, and how you communicate with others, rather than just telling everybody, I am this, and then just acting, you know, reactive throughout life. So I have a little thing to read to you from Venerable Gyatso. this great book, The Perfect Mirror. So it's out of print physically, but you can get it, I think, free online. Maybe Lamyeshi Wisdom Archive, I'm not sure, but it's a really great little Lamrim book in the form of stories. So there's about 30 chapters, each is just a few pages long. And it's just a story with all the Lamrim points in there, but in this wonderful conversational tone. So I like a good story. Anyway, this is what Venerable Gyatso says in the chapter called Religion. Because this force of the white seed isn't to do with belief as such. So he said, in translating a Buddhist work from English into Mongolian, a student at my center had trouble with the word religion because she felt it was synonymous with superstition. Her reaction was understandable considering her background of an education system still heavily influenced by communist anti-Buddhist rhetoric. And I too am reluctant to use the word. My mind has always equated religion with superstition, prejudice, hypocrisy, and the long history of murderous crusades and inquisitions conducted under the auspices of religion. During the extermination of the Cathars in Europe, perhaps the truest Christians of all, a commander, unable to distinguish between heretics and true believers in a French village, gave the infamous order to his troops, "Kill them all and God will take care of his own." So, from the Buddhist point of view, religion should refer to those practices that transform the mind from non-virtue into virtue. Virtue, which involves love, compassion, and patience, is a wholesome state of mind that produces peace and well-being for oneself and others. Non-virtue is the opposite. It's an agitated state of mind, such as the mind of anger and jealousy, which harms oneself and others. The Dalai Lama has said that just as there are many medicines in this world for a particular disease, there are many religious systems that serve to bring happiness to living beings. And even though there are different practices and modes of expression in world religion, there is a common aim to bring happiness to the minds of practitioners by abandoning such actions as killing, stealing, lying, and slander, and cultivating their opposites. His Holiness also remarked on the sad history of struggle and hatred among followers of different religions and declared his wish that religious practitioners be unified without bias towards each other and without hatred for those who do not practice religion, because human conflict in the name of religion is as infantile as the fighting between followers of opposing football teams. So it's just a really nice riff to put it into context. So when we're talking about virtue, virtuous actions, it's not some moralistic code that is imposed upon you. But here, you know, just like His Holiness said, religion should refer to those practices that transform the mind from non-virtue into virtue, to those kind of universal positive qualities. So far, so good. Any questions? Okay. Let me know. So what we have is a 10-point checklist. I love a good checklist. In fact, life at Lungritamba Center was totally revolutionized when I read a book called The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande, a great surgeon. And he transformed the hospitals so that far less infections. And it was from the virtues of a checklist. So this 10-point checklist is a list of what to do and what not to do. And the first thing about this is to figure out that when we talk about misdeeds or non-virtuous actions, there are two types. So one type is called natural misdeeds. So these are universally recognized actions that cause harm or suffering. So you don't need any belief. It's not a cultural thing. You know, for instance, like being punched in the nose. Nobody likes it, not humans. You don't have to believe in pain or suffering or any of those things to actually to have the experience and not like it. Also animals. So there are things that naturally we recoil from that hurt us. And so doing those things is counted as a natural misdeed. It's a universally recognized phenomena. Theft as well, for instance. So theft isn't just an imposed moral code, but animals, if you've put dinner down for a whole bunch of dogs, they don't like the other dogs coming and stealing their dinner. No one likes theft. So it's not a matter of belief. And then we have what's called proscribed misdeeds. So these are actions that aren't inherently bad, just like there are some actions that aren't inherently good. But these kind of actions, even though they're not evil or bad as such, can harm others or lead to more destructive behavior. So for instance, wearing a seatbelt, you know, getting in trouble for not wearing a seatbelt, it's not a karmic misdeed as such. But if you don't wear a seatbelt, the odds of you harming yourself or others are greatly, you know, multiplied. Other proscribed misdeeds are some of the cultural gaffes that we do. So I remember a few years ago, somewhere in the Middle East, someone took off their shoe and hurled it at a politician that they were really disgusted with. And that was like the very worst insult that you could give anyone, is hurling your shoe at them. Whereas in Australia, you know, you just think of like the Melbourne Cup and everyone running around with no shoes and being drunk and just chucking everything around. It's not a proscribed misdeed to hurl your shoes around. But in a different context and a different culture, it's the very, very worst. How much you're allowed to drink or how old you're allowed to be to drink, speeding rules. So they're proscribed misdeeds. They're not inherently bad, but they do have massive effects on society. So you kind of get the idea, don't you? You know, some are agreed upon things, matter of belief or culture, and others are universal. So then we also have naturally positive actions, and then meaningful actions, or ones that we can bring great positivity to. So naturally positive actions like kindness. Kindness is a universal language. Saving lives, protecting the vulnerable, speaking gently across cultures. This is recognized, isn't it? In fact, you can have a conversation with someone in another language and you don't understand each other at all. It's just all through the tone. Just someone wanting to share, be kind, is the communication. Naturally positive actions too, like if you're lucky enough to have a job like teaching kids or, you know, being a nurse or a doctor, looking after the physical welfare of others. If you're able to donate a kidney, cure malaria, educate others, teach others to read. But there are also things that we can do that might seem ordinary, so that we can bring great meaning and positivity to, great benefit to. So it doesn't mean that if we don't have a deep and meaningful job, then we can't be any use. Because what we can do is even just offering someone a cup of tea with kindness, it can make all the difference in the world. A genuine hello can make all the difference in the world. So, you know, there are naturally virtuous things that we can do, and what makes them virtuous really is the motivation and that the impetus behind it of care, like feeding the chickens. So from Buddha's point of view, the things that we can do, we have our 10 virtuous actions to do and the 10 non-virtuous ones to avoid. We have the practice of the 6 perfections. So these are really good lists to make sure that we tick all those boxes. They're short lists. We can tell if we're doing it or not. And they will profoundly change our life. From a non-religious point of view, there are also things to do. So number one, abide by the law so that you don't get into trouble. You don't bring yourself or your family or your workplace into disrepute. So we all know what happens, you know, if you get a speeding ticket and you're a famous person or you're a judge or a whatever, and you get a speeding ticket, you bring a whole lot of people into disrepute. or if you're a family values advocate and then you get sprung having an affair, you know, it's a pretty bad look, isn't it? So number one, abide by the law, keep your vows. It's really simple, isn't it? But how many people don't? Keep your citizenship vows and your marriage vows and your scouts vows, whatever vows that you have, including vows, modern day vows, code of professional conduct. So, you know, teachers and psychologists and psychiatrists and professors, they all have a professional code of conduct to show the safe way so that there's not an abuse of power, to guard against corruption, all of those things. So that's a really powerful thing to do, to keep your professional code of conduct. It becomes a protection. In our organisation as well, the FPMT, we have a professional code of conduct, the ethics policy that all of the registered teachers like myself and Eddie and Venerable Larsam, everyone has to sign that ethical policy. So we have our Buddhist professional code of conduct. Other fantastic non-religious things to do, volunteering, donating to causes that you really believe in, getting involved in things like that. So there is a lot of room to move here of actually getting involved in something that will have this, that is like planting a virtuous seed that will have a fruition into something much, much bigger. So donating too, it doesn't just have to be money, but it can be donating your time, go and sit with the oldies, donating your skills. So I've got all these old sewing machines. I tend to collect sewing machines. I'm not even trying to. And I just got too many. So I was trying to think what to do. And I found out there is actually a place that collects old sewing machines and teaches teenagers about mechanics by fixing up these old sewing machines. So I'm really excited now. I don't have to take them to the dump, but something really good can happen to them. Okay. Now, with our checklist that we're going to have a look at, the 10 non-virtuous actions, so what to avoid. If you manage to avoid those, you're already an excellent human being. And then what to put in their place. So not leaving a vacuum, but what to practice instead. So many of us might think, oh, we're not doing anything very spectacular in our life, but don't underestimate what you're doing, because if you refrain from harm, that is half the story already. Do no harm. So even though it's not obvious that you've refrained from retaliating or you've refrained from saying the hurtful thing, that is as powerful as doing the positive thing. So there's two there. One, to refrain from the harm, and then to build on the positive. And some of these things in the checklist of the 10 non-virtuous actions, for instance, we might think are really obvious and no-brainers, but they're easy because of our cultural circumstances. And again, if we were put into a situation where everything changes, we might not know how we respond. We might be able to have confidence in our response. So, for instance, to refrain from killing, which is the first one. So we've got violence or killing, stealing and sexual misconduct. So to refrain, this one is usually called killing, but I've called it here violence because it kind of expands it out. Because in our culture, killing is rare. We don't have conscription, compulsory conscription. We don't have a civil war. We don't have marauding gangs coming through our villages and our suburbs. So it's very easy to not kill just as a default. But if you think about other cultures, there's no choice, is there? It's just upon you. So a lot of these, how we refrain from things is because all of our circumstances are peaceful and it's very easy to do. We can easily refrain from stealing because we have a social safety net. We have help. And that's all well and good until our circumstances change. And then we might find that because we didn't bring any awareness to it, we weren't consciously refraining from killing or stealing, then circumstances change and we just kill and steal. So what we can actually do is that if we consciously decide not to do these things, even though it's easy, that means we have some confidence within ourselves that when circumstances change, we won't just kind of lose it. And that kind of confidence in yourself, it's quite profound. It flavors your whole life to know your own measure and have confidence in your own responses when circumstances change, to know, to trust yourself. So I have noticed many times in our culture that people will say, oh yeah, you know, I'm a peaceful person until someone gets on my goat and then all bets are off. So that's like, no, you're not a peaceful person, because being peaceful when everything around you is peaceful is easy. It's, you are a peaceful person if you are able to keep your mind calm and non-retaliating when everybody around you is being negative and aggressive. Then you know you're a peaceful person. So how do we actually develop that from the inside? How do we plant that positive seed? By making a conscious effort to avoid killing, violence or aggression. And that one, even though, of course, naturally you do that, to just bring awareness to it. And then what to do instead, the virtuous side of things, is harm minimization. So that's something we can always be working on. So we can go vegetarian if we can. We can, you know, stop all of our retaliatory impulses. And then to do the positive, the opposite, to protect the vulnerable, to save lives, to extend life. So that might be protecting children from bullying. It might be going out and giving blood. It might be saving animals, donating to a wildlife fund. So you can see there's the refraining from the negativity, and then there's putting something in its place, the opposite, the positive one. Contributing to medical research, cancer research, all of those things that enhance and protect life. So that way we bring some awareness to it. And really, we should be able to avoid violence, to never physically threaten anyone. You know, that's a line that we can curtail our physical actions Then we have avoid stealing. So stealing. First, avoid taking what's not freely given. So there's out and out theft, actually taking someone's wallet. There's slightly more once removed theft, online stuff. There's also more subtle theft, like borrowing something and not giving it back, or being really late in paying your bills, or returning things. Other forms of subtle stealing might be to get stuff out of people through manipulation, because so it's not freely given. So, you know, there's the obvious. Don't cheat on your taxes. Don't take your neighbor's milk bottles. You know, wage theft is a really big one. So they're obvious negativities. And then what we can do instead, share. Now, sharing is hard. Take it from me. I mean, you might be good at it, but I am really poor at it. So sharing food, when you've got a plate of cake, offering the best piece to someone else. I've always got my eye on the best piece, you know. So sharing your food, sharing your resources. So poorer cultures, and also cultures that have extreme climates, like extreme hot or extreme cold, are much better at sharing resources, at giving a bed to strangers, at, you know, helping people with their cars broken down, because it is a matter of life and death. So I've been watching this show, Highway Through Hell, in Canada, you know, in the winter, of just saving all these people that have had car accidents in the middle of blizzards and things like that. And it is life and death. So sharing resources, food. The other thing to stop stealing, taking that which is not freely given, and then to give other things, like just doesn't just mean stuff or money, but it also means sharing your time, sharing your attention. And so many times, especially as it gets up to Christmas and we have needy relatives, and it's like, oh, do I want to have to ring them, or do I have to sit down and talk to them? To actually think of it as practicing generosity. I'm going to give you my time for a good half hour, no strings attached. I'm yours. I'm going to pay attention to you. And you give it as a gift. Think of it as practicing generosity. And, of course, trying to pay bills on time, or trying to repay debts on time, because that money is not yours, is it? It's theirs.
Excuse me, Miffy.
Yes, yes.
Just with sharing your time, I have a couple of young nieces and nephews, and while all the adults are doing their adult things and all talking and drinking their coffee and that, I'm the one that's down on the floor playing Lego, reading books, singing songs. And I find that just giving them that bit of attention and that bit of time, I'm the favourite uncle. They just...
Of course.
On these knees. You know, I'm the one that gets to share the Halloween lollies and things like that. But yeah, that example.
It makes a huge difference, because especially if you're the favourite uncle when they're little, then also as they get bigger and life gets complicated, you'll be the trusted one that, you know, they might not be able to talk to their parents, but they'll be able to talk to you. So that's also like planting that positive seed. It has a long-term, it's a long-term investment. Because, you know, as kids become teenagers and there's all of the peer group pressure at school and all the dangers that young impressionable people can fall into, and just so easily their lives go off track. If they're all we need, as we know from our own life, is one person, one adult that's cool, that we know likes us, that, you know, cares for us, doesn't judge us, and we know there is someone we can go to. So Yeah, Daryl, that's a really good example. And it's a lot more than just at the moment, you know, giving them time. It's actually an investment as well.
Yeah, no, I was lucky enough to have an aunt that spent her time with me when I was young doing similar things. So I know how much I enjoyed it. So I love being able to pay that forward.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, pay it forward. Good, good.
I don't have children of my own. I don't think I ever will. But, you know, these are the little people that I can hopefully have some positive influence on. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's also, you know, I'm like that. I'm the auntie with no children. And so, and also I think that, like, it's the aunties and uncles that don't have any kids that are the really cool ones that you like hanging out with and that understand you and that you can kind of tell all your things to. So, okay, so killing, stealing. I've changed that one, the killing, to violence, because we are in quite a violent culture, and people, not so much maybe in Australia, but I've been watching a lot of French movies where people are really violent towards kids. Like, you know, the kids do something naughty, and in the movie, you know, the adults get them and shake them, like, you know, totally invade their space. And just because they're small, they can be physically manhandled. So violence, you know, it has a real effect on people. So to avoid that, we can just control our physical actions. That is relatively easy to do. We mightn't be able to control what we want to do in our mind, but the very least that we can do is control our physical actions so that we are confident that we are a safe person to be around no matter what. And if we're confident about that, of course, the psychological effect for us is we feel safe. We feel safer. Oh, and the last one, sexual misconduct, which means don't cheat on your own partner and don't cheat with someone else's partner. We all know what sexual misconduct means. Actually, refraining from sexual misconduct, well, that's another thing, isn't it? So workplace romances and affairs, I mean, they happen all the time. We know they're wrong. They're wrong because they hurt others. They hurt us and they hurt others. So, you know, then there's don't take The Bachelorette or Married at First Sight as your role model. You're going to be in big trouble. Oh, look at the dross that's on telly. It doesn't give you much help in, well, how do you keep a relationship together? How do you negotiate being attracted to others? What is the nature of that attraction? How do you not betray your partner and still be true to yourself? All of those things. There's not much out there in our common culture. There's just a whole lot of dross. So, you know, it goes back to whatever vows or commitment that we've made, we stick to that. That commitment is what holds us safe. Then try not to exploit the vulnerable. So there are more obvious forms of sexual misconduct, like, for instance, rape in marriage, or in some cultures, you know, you can marry a 12-year-old girl. So there's other things like that would be counted as sexual misconduct that we can work to change society and change the laws and protect the vulnerable. And then what do we do instead? So, you know, if you can stick by your vows and your commitment, and that becomes the real strength of your relationship, then what you can develop is cultivating trust and respecting others. So this one, just generally in relationships, I've often found that, you know, we might be polite to strangers and we're quite rude to those close to us. So just to try and flip that around, to be as polite to those that we live with as strangers. You know, just even that can change everything. That if we actually embody and act out respect for our partners, the rest of our family, that will build a whole lot of strength and trust into the relationship. And it's weird because it's something that we don't think about. You know, it seems maybe a bit formal, but it's worth cultivating. And I just think it's really embarrassing that we put on a good face for strangers, like, you know, being all nice and charming and polite and whatever, and then just drop it all when we get home. Like, that's pretty bad. So really, if we think about it, those that we love, we should show the most respect to, and take a chance to practice some politeness, by not just politeness like being do good, but to actually embody your respect and care towards them, to act it out. So the destructive physical actions, what questions do you have about those? Anything else? Sometimes I find when I do this class, people get really embarrassed because, you know, you think it's easy and whatever, and then you look at it and it's kind of like, oh, look, here the rest of my life, I'm not quite as good as I thought I was. But this is the beauty of a checklist, isn't it? That it is actually that simple. June, questions, comments?
Not really. It's just remembering it all, like, because you get into your old habits sometimes. So I'm, you know, trying to make a very conscious, you know, the motivation's being great, that you went through last week in the meditation, mm-hmm. and how to do the meditation like that. That's helped me a lot. And I've noticed that that's made a difference.
Okay.
So having that, and I think with this, it's a bit like that too, just being going over it and remembering.
Just remembering, yeah. And that's why it's so good to have, like, just this, a 10-point checklist. So three physical things to remember.
Yeah.
And if you just remember them, you're going to naturally you know, bring some energy to that, and then you will start acting differently.
Mm.
And they're very easy to do, you know, no violence, no stealing, no sexual misconduct. It's a pretty no-brainer. And pretty much all the other negative things that we do in life, that we physically do in life, stem from those three. So it's like, cut to the chase, just do the really big obvious ones, tackle those. And as Venerable Rabina said, if you just manage to refrain from those three things, even if you never do anything good on top of it, but you just refrain from those three things, already you are a good human being. Already you are a success as a human being.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too, you know, thinking what you've done good, because I've been starting to do that as well. At the end of the day, instead of like thinking of all the things that I haven't done or that I could have done better, then going, oh gosh. And then now it's like, okay, I start with the good things. And
yes, like, oh, yes.
Okay.
It's good.
So
very good. So yeah, actually we'll look at that more next week too, how to bring that more into a practice of recognizing, because when you do, as you've probably noticed, June, it makes it stronger.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Okie dokie. So now we can go on to something slightly more tricky, which is the avoiding the destructive verbal action. So how we communicate, and there are four things. So the worst four verbal things that we can do: lying, divisive talk, harsh speech, and gossip. So lying, no one likes to be tricked, betrayed. Oops, just trying to get the picture up there. So lying pretty much is, well, there's the out and out lie, but there's also misleading through omission, through not speaking up and giving the wrong impression. So it's not just being pedantic and what do the politicians say? Oh, I misspoke. Like, they don't say, oh, I lied. They just weasel out of it. It's like, no, if you actually mislead through speech, that's counted in that category of lie. If you did actually accidentally say something wrong, you know, that's like a typo. And part of that is that you kind of fess up and you go, oh, whoops, I didn't mean that. So lying also has this effect that many of us do little white lies, and we think because they're little and they have no consequence, it's okay. And just in that short-term context, that's fairly true. It's just a little white lie. But what's been shown to happen is that developing the habit of lying just to save face, usually, oh, I was running late because of the traffic, whereas you're running late because you slept in. So the kind of the little white lies that we do to save face, what it does is it normalizes lying, and it makes it easy to lie. And so then when something more important comes along, it's easy to lie, and the lies become bigger and they escalate. And one of the most interesting studies was how this is what happened with the GFC, the Great Financial Crisis, of just actually, I think that was with theft, you know, just bending things a bit. It normalized it all the way through the culture until it was these really big things. So that's the thing that we've got to be careful with lying, that it's really worth practicing a lot of discipline with our speech to be very clear what we mean. And personally, I found to not just give those little white lie excuses, but at least to just not say anything. I'm sorry, I'm late. And just leave it at that. Don't make the lie about the traffic or whatever. Just leave it at that. And that way, to stop even those tiny little mistruths, and that will save us from the big lies. And anyone who's watched a whole lot of crime movies knows that it's not the little lies that get you in trouble, or it's not the actual initial misdeed, it's the cover-up that gets you. Because you to once lie, then you've got to do another lie to cover that, and another one, suddenly boom. So the opposite of lying, so we refrain from lying, and then to try and tell the truth, but not just the truth. We've got to temper it with, is it also useful to say, and are we saying it in a kind manner? Because just the cold, hard truth, when has that ever gone down well? You know, when someone tells you the cold, hard truth, for instance, criticism, that might be the cold, hard truth, but doesn't land well, does it? So it's got to be tempered with, is it the right time? Is it helpful the way that you've said it? And is it kind? So this is what the Buddha said when speaking, to ask, is it true? Is it useful? Is it kind? So I've really had to try and temper myself, because for many, many years I just thought, just say the truth. And so I'm pretty blunt at times anyway. And so, yeah, I have hurt people because of that, where that was not my intention. All right, so that's the lying. And it's worth putting in the effort for those little ones, just as an exercise. Then we've got divisive talk. So that's like speaking behind people's backs, slander, speaking badly about people, and excessive criticism. So not just ordinary criticism, but just continuous, like an emotional tick, always criticizing. So that becomes divisive talk. And then instead, to actively recognize people's virtues, to give compliments, and support friends, encourage people in virtue, in their good qualities. So you know, we're quite easy to bag people and to criticize and complain about things, but it takes a bit of effort to actually acknowledge, you know, credit where credit's due, to really acknowledge when someone's made an effort, or has really tried their very best to be patient, or to persevere, or you know, to not retaliate, and to actually acknowledge that and say to them, I really admire what you did there. That was great. That was really inspiring. That was really helpful. That contributed to the harmony of the whole company or the family. And to actually say it. And then if you can, and if you have the skills, try and help resolve disputes. Be a mediator. Calm things down. You've got to be quite good at that, though. Otherwise, things may escalate even worse. But a really simple one, the opposite of divisive talk, is to actually give compliments. So many times I will think of something, I'll recognize someone's done something good, or, you know, they got a nice haircut, or they were really good with the kids there or something. And time just barrels on so fast and I don't get a chance to say it. But it is really worth trying to develop that presence of mind to actually give the compliment. And of course, what they say about compliments, so to not go, oh, you're really good at something, but to actually say why or what it is that you're good at. You know, your patience, so impressed with your patience, or how you explain that to that child. So to actually kind of give a reason why, not just a blanket, oh, that was really great, oh, I loved it. So giving compliments, you know, it costs us no money, and a really well-given compliment. Just think, when someone has complimented you or acknowledged your efforts, how, I mean, at the time you might even be a bit embarrassed, but it gives you a real vote of confidence as you go through your life, and it actually supports you. So we can do that for others too, and that's how we create harmony. We can't wait for harmony to happen. We've got to create harmony. Then we've got harsh speech. So harsh speech, yelling, which is usually what we do when we're having an argument. So yesterday I was just out cleaning the pond, and our next door neighbours in the shop there, clearly the lady's going through a divorce. So she went out to the, you know, into the garden there, for their garden, and is just having this rip-roaring argument about the divorce on her phone. I'm just like, oh, you poor people. Just yelling and escalating. Each sentence just got louder and more frustrated and more aggressive. It just does no one any good. It really stirs the pot and makes things worse. So when we're upset, yelling and retaliating, it's the worst thing to do. Threatening speech, bullying people with speech, it's a terrible thing to do. And what it does is it creates for us, the bullier, it creates an environment of paranoia and fear. So it really backfires on us. Sarcasm as well backfires on us. Harsh speech can be quite subtle. I've noticed there's one that happens in our culture that it really rankles with me, and it's when people give an apology and it's not a proper apology, and what the words are is they say, I apologize if I created any upset. I apologize for any harm I might have done. And that word if I created, I apologize if I upset somebody, it minimizes the harm that you've done. Or I apologize for any harm that I've done, it minimizes. Whereas actually, if you're really going to own it, you say, I apologize for the harm I've done. I apologize for the upset. Just own it. So, you know, there's harsh speech, obvious, threatening, frightening speech. But then there's all this measly stuff that white ants our speech. So, you know, if you naturally don't just yell at people or call them names or retaliate like that, then there's these more subtle things that you can work on. And so, of course, using kind words, owning your apology, and saying things that bring happiness. So that just doesn't mean blanket compliments to increase people's pride, but words that bring authentic happiness, that support harmony and, you know, bring meaning. So it takes a bit of thought. and again, harsh speech, we can think it's kind of nothing, but it very quickly becomes a habit. Retaliating, you know, having an argument and just saying that hurtful thing, just throwing it back, very quickly becomes a habit, and that defines us as a human being, and people won't want to be around us. And then gossip or meaningless speech. So just all the gossip mags, you know, just kind of shooting the breeze. And what do we end up usually complaining about? The weather, complaining about the government, complaining about the NBN, usually ends up about complaining. It usually ends up negative from just meaningless talk. It just degenerates. So how to stop this one, which sucks up all of our energy, is to know your purpose for speaking. So if you can, have a meaningful topic. But if you know you're just going to be at Christmas dinner talking about the weather, set your motivation. So you think, I am going to talk about the weather to my, you know, relative that I have zero voting habits in common with. I'm going to talk about the weather to create harmony. I'm going to do so that we feel warmly towards each other. I'm even going to think of some jokes about the weather to strengthen the family. So then, instead of just boring talking about the weather, there is this deeper purpose to it, and then it becomes beneficial. And then it won't end up degenerate into a family argument. So that's why I put in there, plan ahead. Especially if you know it's coming, plan ahead. Have some topics up your sleeve. Dinner parties can be fraught. I personally hate dinner parties. I just can't handle them because it's so difficult to negotiate how to talk about things, what's taboo, what's not. If Eddie goes to a dinner party, he talks about emptiness and death. And if you're not talking about those two things, he just gets up and goes for a walk. Everyone goes, is Eddie okay? It's like, yeah, he's just bored and he went for a walk. And he actually did that one time. And everyone rang me up and said, Eddie's disappeared. And I said, oh, yeah, he's probably just wandered off. And sure enough, he wandered off. And then they said, where were you? And he actually said to the host, oh, yeah, I was a bit bored, so I just went for a walk. But, you know, so if you're Eddie, you just want to talk about what really interests you. And if you're me, I just talk about, you know, all sorts of taboo topics that that probably aren't the best thing to talk at a dinner table. So I plan ahead. And what I've found is a really good thing to plan ahead is asking people, what was their favorite movie this year and why? I used to ask, what was your favorite book? But then I found many people don't read, so that would put people off a bit. So now I just ask a movie. And then that way, for you know, you get to know about someone without being too confronting. So just a little plan like that can be incredibly effective. Uh, So time is going on. Questions or comments about this, about verbal actions or verbal activities?
I like to talk about the weather and then bring it in relation to my garden and what vegetables are growing and, oh, the frost got my pumpkins, or, and hopefully I can sort of connect with someone else. Maybe they've even got pot plants inside or something. And
yeah, that's right. So, and already then there's a purpose, because it's much nicer to talk about how your pumpkins are growing than to just complain about the weather, isn't it? Already it's going in a positive direction. Yeah. And gardening, you know, any form of hobby like that is a great way to connect with others that, you know, it's not fraught with difficulty. Gardening, woodwork, crochet, walking the dog, they're all things that, you know, people can relate to. So, yep, very good. Chooks.
But sadly, I see myself in all four of those things.
Yeah, so, well,
it's sort of, oh, I feel myself going red.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, you'll get used to that experience. That's kind of like relishing, relishing springing yourself, because at least you've gone, aha, I've spotted it now. So I look at all those four and I go, well, at least now that I'm at a Buddhist center, I don't do any of them overtly. Beforehand, before I was at a Buddhist center and I was just, you know, making costumes or whatever and being eccentric, I was just right out there. I had no discipline with my speech. But I can confidently say, like, I've been at Lungri Tumpa Center as the program coordinator for 23 years, and I can tell you I have never yelled at anyone, not once, not even a word yelling in 23 years. Like, I am a safe person to be with. So I might say things a bit blunt, but I've never retaliated like that, never had an argument, no way. And that was because I think, you know, how can you come to a Buddhist center and if you see someone arguing, it's like, this is not, these people are not Buddhist. They might say they're Buddhist, but they're clearly not. So how can I bring that disrepute on the Dharma? How can I betray people's trust? They're coming to a place, they're looking for something and they need safety. How can they even witness an argument? It'd just destroy you. So, you know, that, and now that's become like a strength for mine. Like, I know I'll never bust that. I know that even if I am delirious with the flu or blind drunk or haven't slept in 3 days and don't even know what I'm talking about, I am 100% confident I will never retaliate. I just know that because of that habit. So we can get like that with everything, where we can have that real confidence in ourselves that goes way below the intellect and the habits. It goes right down to the core of your being, and that just comes from practice. Okay, so then very quickly, we've got the mental actions, and these are a bit trickier. Mental activities, not as obvious. Luckily, people can't see what's going on in our head. You know, so physically and verbally, we can pacify those actions and we can be disciplined with our actions and become a good human being to be with. And meanwhile, in the privacy of our own home, we work on the mental activities. So we've got three of the main biggies. So these are, they're motivated by the afflictive states of mind, like, you know, jealousy and pride and attachment or whatever. But through those motivations, then we act. We act mentally or emotionally. It becomes a habit, an action or a reaction. So these activities. So covetousness, just wanting what they've got. Looking at what other people have and going, I just want what they've got. And kind of wanting to take it from them. instead of recognizing that, you know, what they've got isn't random, it comes from causes and conditions. So if we want that, we've got to put in place those causes and conditions. And I mean, covetousness also comes from thinking that that mistaken view, what they've got makes them happy. Therefore, if I had that, I'd be happy. As if our happiness comes from out there. Whereas, as we know, we look at all the happy families and the perfect jobs, and then we scratch below the surface. It's not like that. So what's really eats at us is this covetousness habit of just wanting what other people have. And so to change that habit around, what we do is the opposite, which is rejoicing. Every time someone has something that we want, we go, I'm happy for you. I'm so happy you have that. You've got Elizabeth Taylor's diamonds. I'm so happy for you. You won the lottery. I'm so happy for you. You got that job. You got JobKeeper. I am so happy for you. So you kind of, you go, I would like that. I recognize its value. At least somebody is enjoying it. I am happy for you. So, I mean, for most times I'm quite good at this, but, you know, when we're looking for a bigger, better Lungri Tungpa Centre, a bigger building, I had a little dose of centre envy where I'd hear about the amazing things happening at other Buddhist centres where they got given a big donation or they managed to buy a temple on their credit card or whatever, and I'd get a bit jealous. And I'd have to really watch it that I didn't get jealous, but I actually transformed it into rejoicing. I'm so happy for you. But again, once you practice rejoicing, you get happy. You rejoicing, feeling happy for somebody else means you feel happy. So why on earth wouldn't we want to practice that? And then to kind of just save our jealousy and whatever, there's a little bumper sticker. What I have, it's good enough. It's not perfect, sure, it's in samsara, but it's good enough. And it just takes the pressure off. So the biggest thing with covetousness is to avoid thinking about other people's partners and avoid thinking about other people's wealth. Because that just becomes a really destructive habit. And instead, rejoicing at others' qualities, their good fortune. Ill will, abandon, thoughts of malice, harm, and revenge. So that kind of stewing in resentment. It's very addictive. It's as addictive as covetousness, as you know, driven by attachment. In fact, it's the same kind of addiction, but on the negative side of things. Instead of thinking, whoa, how much I'd love to have that thing and getting all excited and plotting how to get it, you're thinking how much you hate that thing and plotting how to harm it. We can do this, you know, if you've had an argument with someone and you go home and you think of all the things that you wish you had have said, that's ill will. That's practicing ill will. So here we are thinking that we're a good person, and yet what are we practicing? So the moment you notice that you are ruminating on those negative thoughts or those harmful thoughts or relishing harmful thoughts or rejoicing when people you hate, bad things happen to them, going, ha, they deserved it, all of that negativity will backfire on us. So even when the politicians get their just desserts, it's really careful, don't rejoice about that. So instead, cultivate kindness. And how we feel naturally kindly towards others is to find out what you have in common. So, you know, you, neighbors, you mightn't have anything in common, but you each have a cat, or you each have a dog, or you each have a garden. You may have nothing else in common, but the moment you find that common ground, and Daryl, that's why it's so skillful to you know, talk about the weather and then your garden, because you're finding common ground, and that's what works against ill will. It creates harmony. It creates connection. And then once we find out what we have in common, then we can start having kindly feelings towards others. It might take a while to find what you have in common with someone that you really dislike, but it's worth digging around. You might have the same weird taste in music. You might have gone to the same school out back. You know, even if it's just one tiny thing, suddenly they become your people instead of someone other, and that's what you have to find. So there's some great shows on TV for this. Two that I'll mention. One is You Can't Ask That on, I think it's ABC. Can't remember. They're either on ABC or SBS. And so You Can't Ask That, you know, talks to firemen and autistic people and people in prison and disabled and parents and just, you know, each kind of section of society and asks all the outrageous questions. You find common ground. It's super juicy. And the other one is called Everyone's a Critic. And it's just these people going through art galleries, talking about the art, bagging the art, saying funny things about the art, talking about their families in relation to the art. Also really juicy. So ordinary people, so-called ordinary people, you scratch the surface, there's a whole universe there. And that leads us to the hardest one, the mental activity of mistaken views, which is indulging our bigotry, our racism, prejudice, sexism, all of those things. So on a common level, that kind of prejudice is a mistaken view. It creates harm. So it's not that someone has decided it's a mistaken view, but any distortion or prejudice that we have towards others creates harm. So again, shows like that to find what commonality. And many times, like that's why the cooking shows are so popular, because we can bring in all other cultures where normally we'd be scared of the other, frightened of the other. But when it's through cooking, now it's common ground. You can share it. So cultural exchange, education, market gardens, you know, where you have a bunch of flats and you have a garden together and then you talk about cooking. So it brings everybody together instead of focusing on the differences. And that does a huge amount to create harmony. Then to work to change our culture, our society, unfair laws, like, you know, changing the law for marriage equality. But the main thing with wrong views is just to remember that how things first appear to us and how people first appear to us is not how they are. So it means just slowing things down a bit and going, yep, I may have had a bad reaction to this person, but that's not the whole person. So on that level, it can be very simple. It goes all the way to empty of inherent existence and dependent arising, but it starts right here with, I haven't got the whole story. How they appear is not how they are. So just that, just starting there, it's dynamite. With politicians, for instance, for a long time, when, say, John Howard was our Prime Minister, I was very embarrassed to be Australian and I hated on John Howard and, you know, I really didn't like him at all, didn't agree with any of his views. But that appearance of John Howard being bad is not the whole story, apart from the fact that he has family that love him, probably has an animal, a dog or a cat that loves him. But then he also did a really good thing, and I have to remember that. So when the Port Arthur massacre happened, he instituted those that changed the gun laws and the gun buyback. And that was a powerful, amazing thing to do. And that was a genuine, caring thing to do for our society. So I can't hate on John Howard now. You know, so how they appear in my mind isn't how they are. And then that way, that's how we actually create a cohesive society. And it's also how then we can kind of have that true direction path towards liberation and enlightenment. So those are the three activities of the mind. The main thing is to not get too, don't get too disheartened of how difficult they are. Actually, just get started on them and you'll get a lot of energy. You'll get quite heartened. Because, you know, there's the avoiding the negative ones and the most obvious ones we can avoid. We can just, you know, when we notice ourselves getting angry, we can just get up and do something, even if it's digging holes in the garden, to just change it so that we're not creating more disharmony. And then put in place, you know, those in our own time, in the privacy of our own home, we kind of plan ahead. And that's all doable. So there's your 10-point checklist. 10 things to avoid, 10 things to do. We can see why they're there. It's not a matter of belief. They're universal things. And there is a lot that we already do. So we just have to actually acknowledge it. Like you said, June, I really appreciate what you have actually done, how you've refrained from the negativity and how you've actually even done some of those positive things and actually bring some awareness to that and go, yay, good on me. So that's something that we should feel really good about ourselves. That's a positive pride because it's an acknowledgement of really good qualities. And that's how you nurture that seed, that white seed. And so you just get it started, and like in a garden, you know, you just got to be gentle, gentle, gentle in the beginning, and then the rains come and then results, harmonious life, good community. All right, so it's about time to finish for our class today. Let's dedicate our efforts. Recognize, wow, you've already made your life highly meaningful by just coming along this morning. And just by talking about these 10 non-virtues and the 10 virtuous actions, may they be the seeds for our practice. And may we bring that practice to fruition to become a wonderful, flourishing human being. Of course, then we'll be happier, but then more importantly, we'll really be able to contribute to our society and to the world and to all living beings and even save the planet. So let's dedicate to that. So thank you very much. Nice to see your smiling faces and I hope to see you again next week, the last one, session for this course. So that'll be on how to tie up the end of the day.